The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Mac Bolan works night and day to protect the United States of America. But he isn't the only one. The government has had long-standing agents in the field with vital agendas.
Okay, Stryker. What do you know about Project Zodiac?
I've heard rumors. Some sort of doomsday plan from the Cold War.
That's damn close. 12 deep cover agents scattered across Europe, each equipped with a compact nuclear device that fits into a standard-sized briefcase. Each of these has a full 1/4 kiloton yield. Very nasty stuff. Dirty as hell.
But when the unexpected happens...
The bastards got them. Zalharis and his crew stole the entire shipment of Zodiacs.
A band of Brazilian mercenaries known as the Scion hold the trigger on 4 weapons of mass destruction. And they're bringing them on American soil.
These are kamikaze models. Damage the casing, and even if it's not already armed, the bomb will detonate automatically. The Zodiacs have to be recovered intact and undamaged.
The threat is real, and the bloodthirsty mercenaries are already here. Bolan will have to scour the states to track down the heartless killers. And even at the top of his game, he can't be everywhere at once.
Did they just toss something overboard? Why on earth are they...
In the Scion's unholy sale, death goes to the highest bidder. Don't miss 1 minute of Mac Bolan 96. Stolen Arrows.
His parents will christen him Jamie Ian McAllister. The Ohio Shawnees, who massacre his parents and kidnap the 7-year-old boy, will learn to call him Man Who Is Not Afraid. Jim Bowie and Davy Crockett will call him friend and fellow soldier. Dime novels and campfire tales will call him eyewitness to the battle for the Alamo, the Civil War, and the massacre of Little Bighorn. His adventures will take him the length and breadth of a wild and untamed country and become the stuff of American legend. In the tradition of Little Big Man, Graphic Audio is proud to present William W. Johnstone's acclaimed Eagles series, The Chronicles of Jamie McAllister and His Clan, an epic two-fisted saga of action, courage, love, honor, and betrayal. Saddle up. The long ride begins October 2006 with Eyes of Eagles.
And now, our feature presentation.
Previously on Deathlands. Ryan Carter and his friends have survived some harrowing threats in the past, but fate has delivered them at last to a seemingly idyllic locale, their own island in the Florida Keys. A chance to relax, however, is tainted by the sense that more is going on than there appears.
Strangers are welcome. Perhaps I should qualify that a little. Any stranger who comes with hope, love, and friendship in his heart is very welcome.
In the company of a scientific genius, Ryan, Christie, and the others find rest, good food, and a mystery to unravel.
You say this ship was blown up by a mine or by some kind of a rocket?
Not necessarily. I'm saying that two external explosions had ripped her hull apart, and that someone had massacred the crew. The question is, who? And in another part of the Deathlands, Abe continues his search for the elusive traitor.
It's possible. It's possible the traitor's still alive.
He called himself that. Carried an armalite so old it looked like Noah himself used it to blast the dove out of the sky. He left a letter for you, Abe.
At the end of Ryan's journey lie more questions. His esteemed host has an agenda of his own, harnessing creatures of the sea to serve man and protect him from external threats, both from man and Mother Nature. They huddle together in the corridor while JB opened the sealed sectors. The usually smooth gearing and counterweights sounded rusted and damaged, but they worked.
At least we're safe now we're down here. The wave can't get us.
I'm afraid that's not necessarily true, dear lady. When that wave hits the shore, the pressure will be incalculably powerful. It will certainly force the sea through the narrow passage and into this corridor with the most extraordinary force. It will remain intensely dubious whether even these steel sectors will protect us.
Shit. Let's get this jump made triple fast.
The quake and the storm had done further damage to the already ravaged control room. A scummy layer of brackish water covered a quarter of the floor, salt stains on the ceiling and walls showing where it had found its way through from the sea above. The cracks all around the room gave mute support for Doc's fears concerning the effect of the tsunami. The pale yellow walls of the gateway were hardly visible in the poor light. Only about one-third of the light seemed to be working in the complex. As they made their way toward the heart of the Matrans unit, there was a severe jolting shock, and another bank of neon tubes plunged into darkness.
By the three!
Things were moving too fast. Ryan led the way to the open armorglass door of the gateway chamber, ushering the others through. His mind was filled with the image of the tidal wave, bigger than anything he could have imagined in the deeps of a jolt nightmare, plunging toward them. How close was it now? 10 miles still? 5? Or 1?
It has to be close.
How close?
Close.
Doc found a moment to give Ryan a friendly pat on the shoulder as he joined the others in the chamber. Ryan hesitated a moment, wondering whether there was still time to go back and drop the sectors.
No.
Everyone was sitting on the floor, their backs against the walls, waiting for Ryan to join them. For a fraction of a second, Ryan realized that he truly wanted to know what would happen when the tidal wave struck the keys. Was Doc right? Would the gateway suddenly flood with seawater under such pressure that it would crush flesh? It would be amazing to see that.
Lover!
Ryan shook his head, glancing once around the room at the others, and smiled.
Might one ask what is so profoundly amusing, my dear Cotter?
I was just thinking. We look like a warren of drowned rats.
Ryan's hand was on the heavy door, ready to pull it shut and trigger the Matran system that would propel them into elsewhere.
Here we go.
He sat by Christie, with Dean on his left. Doc was opposite, lying on his side, his knees drawn up to his chin. Everyone else had assumed the positions that they knew from experience would be most comfortable for the jump. Ryan took Christie's hand in his. The lights outside dimmed, and he heard the crackling of a major electrical circuit malfunctioning. The metal discs and floor and ceiling began to glow, and the pale yellow armorglass started to pulse with the familiar misty light. The inside of his brain was beginning to float in the familiar fashion that he hated so much.
Something's wrong.
Was that voice his father's? It couldn't be. An old man. Doc. Something was wrong. It felt wrong. Ryan tried to grip Christie's hand more strongly, but they were suddenly wrenched apart with a dreadful force and violence. He could hear the roaring of the mighty water, and his breathing was choked.
Wrong!
The darkness swam around Ryan, and he realized with a chilling terror that he was completely alone. Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King Williams, Nanette Savard, Ken Jackson, Karen Carbone, Casey Jones, Sonny Lasky, James Konacek, Christopher Walker, and Mort Shelby. Deathlands number 20, Cold Asylum. Ryan opened his eye. He swallowed, tasting the yellow bitterness of bile at the back of his throat, the inside of his skull still swimming in its own secret sea. His muscles ached as if he'd been on the wrong end of a beating in an alley behind a frontier gaudy.
Fire blast!
The mist in the chamber of the gateway was clearing slowly, the metal plates losing their silvery glow. He noticed that the armor glass walls were rich deep purple. Coming out of a jump, the brain never functioned all that well. Ryan couldn't remember seeing walls of that color before. He also felt more deeply sick and confused than he could remember, and he looked around the six-sided room to check on how the others were feeling. But there was nobody else there. He was on his own. That wasn't possible. He'd closed the door himself and triggered the jump mechanism in the buried redoubt in Florida, and everyone had been together then. Ryan bit back the desire to vomit. He closed his eye again, battling for self-control, and checking in his memory where everyone had been sitting. Christy had been sitting next to him, her brilliantly red hair, dark and wet, pasted to her head, her long legs stretched out in front of her, back against the wall, fingers clasped in his. Then some incredible force had torn them apart. Ryan seemed to remember that. She'd been on his right, with his 11-year-old son Dean on the left. The boy had been toying with his beloved turquoise-hilted knife as he sat and waited patiently for the jump to begin. His big 9mm Browning automatic pistol had been jammed into a holster at his belt. Who'd been next in the circle?
Mildred.
Ryan could see the Black Doctor in his mind's eye. A relative latecomer to the group of companions, in the 20th century, the 36-year-old woman had been taken into hospital for minor abdominal surgery. Things had gone wrong, and she'd been placed in cryogenic suspension, frozen, a state from which Ryan and the others had eventually freed her nearly a century after her death. Recently, she had deepened her relationship with the armorer of the group, John Barrymore Dix, who'd sat next to her. About the same age as Ryan, JB was his oldest friend. The two of them had traveled for years with the legendary traitor, rising in the ranks to become his two most trusted lieutenants as they ranged all across the Deathlands. Thinking about the traitor brought a flicker of memory to Ryan. Abe, another comrade from the savage days riding the war wags, had gone off to search for the man. How long ago? Weeks? Months? Years? Ryan couldn't remember. He knew that his old leader had vanished during one long-ago night. Everyone thought that the rat cancer had overwhelmed him, and he'd gone off to die like an animal in some cramped, dark place. Then the rumors started the traitor might not be dead after all.
Abe?
Ryan tried to remember whether the gunner had been with them in the gateway in Florida. He was sure that he hadn't. But there had been others. Christy, JB, Dean, Mildred, and Doc. Of course. Doc Tanner, lying doubled up on the far side of the chamber, knees cracking as he composed himself, his mane of bedraggled white hair framing his lined face. Doc's age was a bizarre enigma that Ryan had never been able to understand. He knew that Theophilus Algernon Tanner had been born on the 14th day of February in the year 1868. He'd been married to Emily, née Chandler, on the 17th day of June, 23 years later. He'd obtained his doctorate in science at Harvard and a PhD from Oxford University in England. Tall and skinny, Doc had been a happy man with a 3-year-old daughter, Rachel, and a little son, Joyon. Then, white-coated, faceless scientists 100 years in the future had destroyed Doc's life. He'd been plucked into 1998 from 1896 as one of the few successful guinea pigs from Operation Kronos, a time-trawling government project that generally brought only mangled piles of unidentifiable meat, blood, and raw bones from the past. Doc had proved so difficult a guest of that particular present that they had eventually pushed him forward another 90 years or so into the Deathlands.
And Michael?
Michael Brother had been brought into their world as another faulty experiment of Kronos. Since his birth, he had been an oblate, a trainee monk, in a closed community called Nilvanity above Visalia in the Sierras. 19 years of age, he had been disciplined into the martial art of Dao Ting Do and had the fastest fighting reflexes that Ryan had ever known. That was all of them, wasn't it? The name of Jack Lauren came unbidden into Ryan's mind. Had Jack been with them in Florida?
No.
The albino youth had traveled with Ryan and the others through many lethally desperate adventures. Now he was married to Christina, and they and their child Jenny lived on a spread in New Mexico. Ryan managed to get himself upright, conquering the sickness, trying to get his brain working. They had all been together as the jump began, but there had been some kind of electronic malfunction. He recalled that. Could that have been responsible for the jump going so wrong? Were the others together? Or had each of them been sent tumbling through time and space to different locations? He breathed deeply, trying to deduce some clue from the taste of the air. Most gateways were buried deep within the old top-secret military installations called redoubts. They were generally powered by long-lived nuke generators that kept the heat and lights in the complexes functioning at survival levels. The air didn't smell like it normally did. Most jumps took the companions to gateways where the air was stale, dusty, and dull. It often hadn't been breathed by anyone for close to a century, since the nuke cataclysm of 2001 that had wiped away civilization. This air was fresh and clean, warm, with a strange foreign scent to it that Ryan couldn't quite identify. Automatically, he checked through his personal armory of weapons, then adjusted the long white silk scarf around his neck, fingering the weighted ends that turned it into such a lethally effective garrote. A fresh wave of dizziness made Ryan stagger, and he leaned his hand on the cold glass wall. What was happening didn't hang together for him. How could they all have been in the Florida Gateway and then end up in different destinations? He was assuming that the others had materialized somewhere else in the Deathlands. The idea that they hadn't was too appalling to entertain. To try to steady himself, Ryan drew his blaster from its holster. The familiar shape made sense to him, and he lifted it closer to his face to peer at it. The trusty Sig Sauer Model P226 that he'd carried for so many years had never let him down. Ryan took several more slow, deep breaths, reciting the vital statistics of the gun, just to hear himself speak and curb his dizziness.
9mm. 15 rounds with push-button mag release. Weight 25.5 ounces. Barrel length 4.4 inches. Total length 7.7 inches. Built-in baffle silencer.
He holstered the gun and stopped to pick up the rifle that lay on the floor by his feet. His free hand had been gripping the sling on the Steyr SSG-70 during the jump, which explained why it had come along with him. The bolt-action 10-round blaster fired the uncommon 7.62mm bullets, and Ryan had intended to try to find some way of changing it for a long gun that used a more standard caliber. Ammunition was a whole lot better than gold in the Deathlands. If you didn't have any, it was almost impossible to obtain. If you had plenty, then you could generally find a way of getting hold of even more. It had been something that Trader had constantly drummed into every man and woman who rode and fought with him on the lumbering war wags. Ryan recalled one of his more succinct and memorable sayings.
No bullets. Get you dead.
Ryan was starting to feel better. Talking to himself was doing him good. There were two simple options. One was to open the door and then close it again. About the only thing that they managed to learn about the lost science of gateways was that this would normally speed you straight back to where you'd been. But Ryan's guess was that the Florida Matrans chamber might well now be destroyed, flooded full 10 fathoms deep in salt water. The other option was to go outside, to try to find where in Deathlands he'd landed, and begin the monstrously difficult quest of trying to track down Christy, Dean, and the others. Ryan drew the Sig Sauer in his right hand, and reached out with his left toward the control on the door.